Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning, Andrew. How are you?
I'm slightly hungover.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any particular reason?
Well, it was
St. Patrick's Day,
I think. Yeah, exactly. The national day of drinking here in Ireland yesterday, so...
It's also weirdly a national day of drinking in this country as well, judging by how full all the pubs were yesterday.
Yes, it seems to be a tradition that has spread across the world, almost as if Irish people, you know, have emigrated in their tens and hundreds of thousands over the years and set up roots all over the place, you know, Irish bars, wherever you look.
That's true.
You see?
That is true. I would say that some of these people I saw in the pub yesterday drinking pints of Guinness, I'm not convinced every single one of those had Irish DNA, but fair play to them. Fair play to St. Patrick. Well, you know, nice to be remembered, I guess.
I guess so.
You did get rid of all those snakes, Andrew. That's what you got to remember.
Yeah. Oh, I remember. I remember. Ireland used to be fucking full of snakes.
Crawling with them.
Everywhere.
I know.
None anywhere.
You're not a fan, really, of snakes, are you?
Well, I mean, is anyone like a fan of snakes?
Not really. I mean, there are people who have snakes as pets, which I just think is crazy.
I don't know what you get from a snake as a pet because it's, you know, obviously you got to live in a, what do you call them? Like,
box.
I was thinking of like, what's the dry equivalent of an aquarium? But you've got it right there. A box. Yeah. Some kind of glass box.
You know. But they get out. As far as I can tell, they always get out. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm always hearing about, oh, yeah, my mate had a snake at uni, but it escaped into the halls and ate four students or something, you know?
Because you've got to get, like, if you're going to have a snake, you've got to get one of the big ones, right? There's no point having, like, a teeny tiny worm-adjacent snake.
You might as well have a worm, do you know what I mean?
Well, that's it. And oh, God, I bet people do keep worms as pets.
Yeah, and just in really small boxes.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to have a snake, it's got to be massive, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's to be like, look how big my snake is. I'm not compensating for anything, but look at this python that I own.
My anaconda says so much about my personality.
Yeah. Don't want none unless you've got buns, hon. I wouldn't like that snake in the house.
No. No.
There's a good program on telly. It's on like one of the bad channels. You know, like when you scroll past your BBCs and your ITVs and your Channel 4s, which are quite bad channels on their own at times.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into the sort of the lower reaches of the TV guide.
Yeah, like Channel 173 or something.
Yeah. There's some program called like Snake Hunters or something like that.
Right.
And they're guys who go around, I think it's Australia, and they get snakes out of people's homes. And let me tell you, it's absolutely terrifying. But quite good fun.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that is the advantage of being in a snake-free country. We don't, you know, we don't have that. You don't have anything under the toilet seat that's going to, you know, bite you and kill you, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. And you've got St. Patrick to thank for that.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, everybody said thanks to him yesterday in the shape of many, many, many pints. It was a very, wandered into town, you know, and just had a bite to eat somewhere relatively quiet. We managed to find somewhere relatively quiet, but then went for a pint afterwards. And it was getting a bit leery. One guy was demanding that he be allowed into the pub that we were going into. And when the owner told him, no, you're not allowed in because you're way too drunk, he insisted that this man show him proof that he was the owner of the pub. I don't have to take your word for it. This was at 5 o'clock. Wow. This was not like 11 o'clock when people have been out all day. I mean, that guy had obviously been out all day. So I spare a thought for all of those people who worked in the hospitality industry in Ireland and Dublin yesterday. Taxi drivers having to take these people home. I hope they can enjoy a couple of days off because I'm pretty sure they're going to need it after the mayhem. So
quite intense. So I was at a I was in a pub yesterday, but at a 1 year old's birthday party. And let me
tell
you,
I didn't know they had them in pubs these days. You know, they grow up so fast. Don't they
start them young. Yeah. Actually, Rocky was with me. Obviously, I didn't go on my own, and he was obsessed with trying to get behind the bar. Basically, he can walk now. He's 11 months old.
Right.
And he, all he wanted to do is get behind the bar. He must have tried to get behind the bar, I would say, 30 times. And on every occasion, I had to sort of remove him. But maybe that's his destiny. Maybe that's his future.
He, I think, is demonstrating to you that he is going to be a persistent young man.
Yes, he is. For example, I would pick him up from the sort of little door through to the bit behind the bar and take him as far away as I could within the confines of the pub, and within about 30 seconds he would be back there. It was quite extraordinary. He was drawn to it like a moth to a flame.
It's amazing. You just leave him somewhere on the North Circular Road. 20 exactly. minutes later, he's found his way back and he's burrowing his way towards the bar.
If,
yeah.
If he ever disappears from home, I know where he'll be trying to get behind that bar.
Fair enough. There was a lot of football on this weekend, but I didn't really see any of it or very much of it. It's an Arsenal-free weekend, of course.
Yes,
because we're not involved in FA Cup action, and the game that we were supposed to play this weekend in the Premier League was against Chelsea, but they were in FA Cup action, so we weren't playing at all.
They were, and they were very nearly held to a draw by Leicester City. They scored twice in stoppage time to win it. If you haven't seen a kick of that, I would recommend seeking out De Zassi's own goal.
Oh, yeah.
For Chelsea. Honestly, Lee Dixon would be proud. It is a quite extraordinary strike.
Right.
For a player who I've always enjoyed because his name sounds so similar to disaster, and there have certainly been moments in his young Chelsea career where that's been applicable. The headlines have kind of written themselves. None more so than when he booted the ball in from 40 yards out.
Oh, his left foot. I'm just looking it up here. I'm going to see if I can find it.
I think maybe the Emirates FA Cup rights. Eligible on YouTube. You've got it.
Dodgy source. Hang on.
Well, let's.
There's some commentary, which I just muted. So I'm watching the Leicester player. Oh, the goalkeeper gives him a kiss. Isn't that nice? Did you see that?
Yeah.
Goalkeeper came up and just gave him a kiss to comfort him. Here it is. Come on, show me the actual replay here, please. Okay, foul throw. Oh, that's a tidy finish. Do you know what it reminds me? It reminds me of that. Reminds me of that goal Kevin De Bruyne scored against us last season.
Right, where it's like, you know, if you're going to score, you've got that postage stamp area to punt it into the net. And, you know, he absolutely does it.
Wow.
You don't see own goals like that anymore, Andrew.
Very rarely. Very rarely.
You see like a miscued clearance or a despairing slide to get to a cutback. You don't see old-fashioned own goals where someone like, you know, smashes it in from pretty far out.
Just fucking hoofed it, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then in the pub, the United Liverpool game was on.
Right.
So I saw bits and bobs of it. Yeah, quite an extraordinary game. I mean, it's being called one of the classic FA Cup ties. But as an Arsenal fan, the funniest thing about it was Erik ten Hag's post-match press conference.
Oh, my God. I have a clip. I'm going to play this clip because people, you know, if they haven't heard it already, I'm sure everybody has or they're aware of it. But I do think it is extraordinary. This is the question that's put to him and then also the answer.
Could be, but we missed so many opportunities. For instance, in Arsenal already in the fourth game of the season, where we in the 87th minute we should have had a penalty on Rasmus Højlund. Then we scored with Garnacho, disallowed, and then we concede a goal that should always have been disallowed. And so such moment can help you. Every team needs such moment into a season, and we never had that moment. Yeah, this could be that moment.
What the fuck is he on about? Like, genuinely, what the fuck is that guy talking about?
Just to be clear, the game he's talking about was on September the 3rd.
Yes.
And he's still harking back to that. I'm pleased for them that they finally found their moment to get into the season halfway through March. But, yeah, I mean, extraordinary. Also, his refusal to accept what seemingly an objective decision on Garnacho being offside for his goal is extraordinary. I remember at the time he did the whole wrong angle thing when he was told, you know, about the angle that they used. But he's not moved on. We're living rent-free in his head, Andrew, as they would say on the internet.
Yes, there was a tweet which I kind of liked. I'm doing the man a disservice. Lachlan Tate said, with Ten Hag's post-Liverpool comments in mind, should we be worried about having a limited transfer budget in the summer due to the abundant rent payments we are paying to stay in his head for months on end? But, you know, as you say, we're there rent-free. I mean, it is extraordinary by any measure to sort of, you're through to the FA Cup semi-final. You've beaten Liverpool in an incredible game, by all accounts, although, you know, the two goalkeepers were just a shambles from the highlights that I saw. So you're through to the semi-final. You're playing Coventry, who've beaten Wolves, and Coventry, like, you know, fair play, well done, but you know, United are obviously clear favourites to make it through to the FA Cup final for the second successive season. And you're asked if this can be a turning point, and you go and start talking about a goal that was offside. He's still the only person on the fucking planet who thinks that the Højlund incident was a penalty. And what's he talking about with the goal that should have been disallowed? Why should an Arsenal goal have been disallowed? Was he talking about the Declan Rice goal?
Yeah, I think maybe there was I can't remember, but there was some talk of a foul in the box on the set piece. I can't remember if it was Gabriel or probably Ben White, let's be honest. But yeah, very, very strange. I've said it before. I think he seems like quite a strange guy, Ten Hag. Like, there's something slightly odd about him. And yeah, it's obviously not working out for him at United at the present point in time, despite being through to the FA Cup semi-final. But it's odd what he seems to be hung up on.
Yeah. I mean, I think all football managers to some extent or another are a bit strange, you know.
For sure.
Like
yeah.
Obsessive or whatever, you know. I think it just comes with the job because it is when you step back and think about it objectively, a really weird job. In that, you know, you work and work and work, and then you place everything that you do in the hands of 11 other people and hope for the best kind of thing. So it's
kind of a similar psychological profile to a cult leader, I think, at times. But he is particularly, I don't know. Like, he's obviously got a good coaching record from Ajax, and, you know, there must be something compelling about him for him to have got the United job in the first place. But every time I see him speak in public – some sort of alarm goes off in my head.
Yeah.
That's all I can say about it, really.
Yeah, just very, very, very strange for him to come out with that, rather than just being happy about winning a game. Do you think maybe he's, you know, looking ahead a little bit to our game against them in the not-too-distant future? Do you
Possibly.
Think that could be part of it?
Possibly.
I mean, that's meat and drink, perfect fodder for Mikel Arteta, though, if that's what he's trying to do. You know, we know what Arteta will make of that kind of stuff and how he will use that for his own players, saying, look what this weird guy is saying about you, and he's talking you to, you know.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about United is that as poorly as they've played for most of the season, they have actually picked up quite a lot of results. I mean, I'd say many more results than they've sort of deserved on merit. Quite how they've managed to do that, I don't know. But it's, and again, another one at the weekend, you know, beating Liverpool, I think, is a pretty significant result for them. So as much as I have enjoyed mocking them all season, I don't take it for granted that we'll go to Old Trafford and walk all over them. I just think when you look at our track record in that fixture, I think it'll be tougher than we might expect.
Oh, no, sure. I was not taking anything for granted either. I think it's going to be very tough, and we've got some very, very tough games in this run-in. You know, the finishing line is sort of over the hill and not too far away, but there's a lot to do, and typically this is always a difficult game for us. But, you know, if I were an opposition manager, I would give Mikel Arteta nothing whatsoever to work with. That's just
sit in silence in your press conferences in the weeks before,
or you know, just answer questions in a way that don't bring up something that's completely irrelevant to what the question I've been asked is about, like how he's got that through line between beating Liverpool on the 17th of March, and that this might be the moment that kickstarts their season, and has somehow connected it back to the third or fourth game of the season, as he said. I've got no idea.
Yeah, still rankles with him. Mad. Absolutely mad.
Yeah. So what else? What else? I mean, we didn't talk on air anyway about the Champions League draw. We spoke about it on Friday a bit with Lewis on the Arsecast. But your thoughts on our old friends Bayern Munich?
I know. I mean, I suppose my thoughts are, they're mostly tough draws, aren't they, at this stage?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the last eight of the Champions League, so there aren't many easy draws. You know, I think the one people looked at was maybe Dortmund, might have been favourable. But I think everything else has its own challenges. I think for me, Bayern is kind of a nice balance of a big challenge, a big game, like a real kind of glamour prestige game, but also one that we can win. And for me, like, that's sort of what the Champions League ought to be about, really. I mean, I didn't want to draw Man City yet for a host of reasons, but one of the main reasons is just because I don't think it feels like a European tie. And actually, I'm really glad that we can't face City in the final, because I just think two English teams playing at Wembley, if we got there, I just don't think it would feel quite right as a European final. I'd much rather the narrative where, you know, we get Barcelona and Vengeance of 2006. And, you know, that's what I want in my heart. But, you know, long way to go until that. I suppose the lack of away fans could be a real benefit for Arsenal.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They won't have any fans with them when the game is played at the Emirates. And look,
I believe Arsenal are going to be selling those tickets. That's the plan anyway.
As opposed to just leaving 3,500 empty seats.
Yeah, exactly right. 60,000 gooners could be a pretty good night. It'll need to be right, because that's the first leg.
Yeah.
And you know, I think generally it's seen as preferable to have the second leg at home.
Yeah.
But I guess if we win the first leg 5-0 or 6-0, as I imagine we will,
yes,
you know, it should be fine.
I mean, we have faced Bayern many times in the past. Do you remember the last time we drew them? We were talking about it on the podcast as the draw was being made, and we sort of joked like, it'll be Bayern again, da da da. This is how it went down, if you don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, his wife's going to be furious because it's so close to Christmas. Do you know what I mean? She probably was thinking, I'll give him that on a big day.
Oh, no. For fuck's sake.
No, you're joking.
Yeah, no, seriously.
Oh, seriously. My God.
Oh, my God. Just what the...
I mean... Right, that's it. Cancel the podcast.
I'm fucking out of here. What the fuck? So thank you.
We took it well. We took it well. I suppose it's indicative of how far we've come that we're so much more relaxed about it this time.
Yeah.
I guess it's got a slight sort of sheen of novelty applied to it because it's been a few years, best part of a decade since. But wow. Yeah. I mean, what's your sort of overall feeling about it?
I think it's just a good European tie. And like you say, at this stage of the competition, you're going to be facing a top team. And, you know, when the first four teams qualified for the knockout stage, was it Man City, PSG, Real Madrid and Bayern Munich? Were they the first four to go through?
Possibly.
I think. And you're looking at it going, Jesus, you know, there's a fair amount of pedigree there and quality there. And this is what it's going to be like when you're at this stage of a competition. You know, it's possible, of course, that the draw could be made and you end up with somebody, who's managed to sneak their way through unexpectedly. But I don't know that really happens as much anymore, does it?
Because it doesn't feel like it. No. We're not in the Europa League anymore, Toto. That's kind of how it felt, that draw.
That's it.
And what about the semi-final draw?
Bring me Real Madrid. Real Madrid. I want Real Madrid to destroy Manchester City. I'm like you. You know, there's something horrible about losing a big European cup tie. Like, it's not pleasant, it's not fun, whether you're in the final, semi-final, quarter-final, whatever it might be, it's no fun, but it is worse when you lose to another English team.
Mm-hmm.
This is just something I can't... how do you explain it? You know the way that human beings have a natural aversion to death and corpses?
Yeah.
I'm like that with English teams in European football. I just have this aversion that's sort of hardwired into my DNA. I can't bear it. You know, you think about the... Fuck. You know, I don't even want to start thinking about some of the games and some of the scars that have been inflicted upon us. But, you know, sure. I can say Chelsea and...
Wembridge, Cristiano Ronaldo.
I can say Manchester United. I can say Liverpool that season when... You know, we had that extraordinary, was it a quarterfinal against Liverpool? I can't quite remember. You know, the one where they got the bullshit penalty and Hleb got, like, basically assaulted in the box and didn't get a penalty. And, so those kind of live longer in my mind and my psyche than any kind of 5-1 against Bayern Munich, which isn't to say that was any fun, but... I can live with those much more easily than I can going out to another English club. So anyway, I would want Manchester City to get beaten because fuck Manchester City. But from the perspective of what it might mean for us as a semi-final, Arsenal versus Real Madrid is something that you can look forward to, I think. Whereas Arsenal versus Manchester City, there's just too much dread. For me, anyway, I don't know if you feel the same or if people listening feel the same. Like, I would not relish that at all. Whereas I can look at Real Madrid and say, they're a brilliant team with brilliant players and a manager, you know, who just has this record in the competition that's incredible. But because of the sort of geographical aspect of it, it feels much more exciting to me as a potential semi-final.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Look, I take nothing for granted, and I think the tie between us and Bayern is really close. You know, I think it's 50-50 almost, really, in terms of who will go through there. But a path to the final of Bayern, Real Madrid, and then, you know, potentially Barca in the final, that would be really the stuff of legend. I mean, look, if Arsenal match somehow managed to get over the line, lift the European Cup, it would be the stuff of legend regardless. But I personally would love that sort of progression. And I think City as well, like, it's all bound up with the title race. It's so... I think it would be so draining to kind of have to face them twice in the Champions League during the sort of thick of the run-in as well. And to be honest, I think they would handle it much better than us. That, I think that's my deep-rooted fear. I think they would be much better placed. I think it'd be water off a duck's back to them, but I think for us, it could be too much.
Is that because of their experience?
Yeah,
because
I think
this is a really interesting aspect of the Champions League this season for Arsenal. Like, maybe we talked about this at the start start of the season and were asked a question about, like, what would be a sort of good European campaign for Arsenal. And maybe, you know, we said getting to the quarterfinals of the Champions League should be sort of like the minimum. Mm-hmm. But I think you could see in the game against Porto where experience at this level and in this competition is really important. And I'm not saying that I expected Arsenal to just turn up and roll over Porto or anything like that. I think they're a good side. And we saw over the course of the two games and all the minutes that we played against them how well organized they are, but also how much I think the experience of European competition can benefit you when you're playing against a team and a group of players that don't really have very much of that. You know, Jorginho had some. Kai Havertz obviously has some. But beyond that,
very little.
There is very little of it in this Arsenal team. And it's part of, you know, how we're going to progress and how we're going to develop as a team is playing these games and playing a big game against Bayern. I think will be absolutely foundational for some of these players, regardless of, you know, how the tie turns out. And obviously I hope it goes the right way for us, but I think it's one of those where, not that we have to ease ourselves back into European competition, but we have to understand the nuances, let's say, of Champions League football again. And, you know, speaking of experience, the manager doesn't really have very much of it either. Like, he's obviously worked with Pep and done that at Manchester City and been part of a coaching team, but this is, you know, this is his gig, and he too, like many of the players, is sort of dipping his toes into the Champions League water as a manager. Obviously he played games for Arsenal in the Champions League, but as a manager, dipping his toes in for the first time.
Totally, yeah. That's what I was about to add, that it's new to him as well. If Arsenal can get past Bayern, then they've had a good first entry into the Champions League. Very good indeed. And after that, who knows? But, you know, I think it's hard to gauge Bayern, isn't it? Because they're obviously a way off Leverkusen in the Bundesliga. But they do seem to absolutely trounce, you know, the bottom half of the German table. But again, it's sort of difficult to properly contextualize that and figure out quite how good they are. I guess we'll find out in a couple of weeks' time.
I mean, I did say it to Lewis on Friday, you know, and he is a keen Bundesliga watcher. Yeah. Sort of, you know, some of it is down to Bayern not being as good as they were and a bit of instability in the Thomas Tuchel thing is played out over the course of the season. But also, look, what Leverkusen are doing is extraordinary. You know, by their standards and by anybody's standards, they're 25 games into the season. They haven't lost a game. Yeah. We did have a question here, a couple of Champions League related questions. So let me see if I can find the one that I was going to ask you. And it's not from the Discord, so it must be on Twitter. Yeah, it comes from Matt Taylor, AFC Matt09. Morning, both. Do you think Arteta will speak to Xhaka and Alonso about Bayern in preparation for the quarterfinal ties? Obviously, Xabi Alonso, Mikel Arteta, good friends, grew up together, grew up playing football together. You have to imagine there'll be a conversation between the two Basque managers about Bayern and, you know, how Alonso set up tactically against them and whether that's something that Arsenal can take lessons from or replicate.
They beat them comfortably, didn't they?
Yeah, 3-0 recently, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm sure there will be a conversation. But by the way, on the subject of Mikel Arteta, I saw this weekend he is back in Spain with his staff. I think they were sort of mingling with the, I think it was the Real Madrid youth coaches, and they were over there like doing some work together, and I think they even played a little friendly game.
There was a match, wasn't there? Real Madrid versus Atletico Madrid at youth level. Yeah. I have a question about that, but okay. you carry on. And
No, I was just saying it's interesting to see what they have got up to, I suppose, in this little mini break. You know, they've chosen to do something together. I know that all the players have been off since Wednesday, actually, so they've sort of scattered around the globe doing their own thing.
Mm.
But the coaching staff stuck together.
The question I was going to ask you about this was because I think it was David Ornstein maybe reported in an Athletic Q&A maybe last week, the week before, about the way Arsenal were going to maybe just do things a little bit differently when it comes to recruiting some youth players. And we have signed a 16-year-old Welsh international, youth international, Braden Clark. He came from Wolves. That was announced last week. And I wonder if part of what we might do at youth level, because we have these two prospects, maybe it's unfair just to say two, but certainly in Ethan Nwaneri and Miles Lewis-Skelly, there are two players who are being very, very hotly tipped to be able to make the breakthrough at Arsenal, even in this sort of raised standard of Arsenal, right? But at youth level, there's sort of a gap, isn't there, between those two who are 16 and 17 respectively, and maybe players who are perhaps of an age where you could start blooding them in the first team. Ruel Walters is 19 or 20, something like that. Players around that age, and I'm wondering if part of why they were over there, you know, might have been just a coaching symposium, just get your heads together with some colleagues. But I wonder, is there part of it that they are sort of running the rule over a couple of youth players at some of these big Spanish clubs and clubs around Europe?
Perhaps so, yeah. I think it's, as you say, David reported it, but I think there is a bit of budget to go into the academy in terms of bringing talent in starting this summer. And I think it's kind of a necessity. I think that we don't have enough quality and depth in our youth sides. And I think there's two reasons to kind of improve upon that. One is obviously, you know, potential first team players or players who can be sold for profit down the line. But also I think it's to make the academy teams competitive and make them, you know, really effective and sort of a good environment to develop players in, because they're strong teams that dominate games and win games. So I think it makes sense to me. And I sort of think it's an interesting time, really, because Arsenal have had these big academy wins. You know, I'm talking about the guys who are currently in the first team. Bukayo Saka is maybe the youngest of that group, but then you've got people like Eddie and Reece Nelson. You know, it's been quite a fruitful time in terms of first team appearances by academy players. But since then, there's not been a great deal coming through. And actually, like, if you think about Per Mertesacker and his time in charge of the academy, he's probably still waiting for like his first player to come through, like a guy that's like a Mertesacker guy that's been produced by the academy. And I think there's probably a little bit of pressure there in that respect. So yeah, I'm really interested to see, like, over the next, I guess it's going to be over the next 2 or 3 years, you know, what do we see of Nwaneri? What is their development path? What about Lewis Skelly? What about some of these other players who we can bring in, spend a bit of money if required to kind of give us the depth and quality in the academy? Because, yeah, I think it's, you know, we've sort of ridden the wave, haven't we, of Saka for quite a while. And Arsenal's academy's had a lovely press off the back of that. But in terms of actually producing players and putting them into the first team, it's harder and harder given the level that we're playing at. And it's more and more difficult to get, you know, those breakthrough stars.
What do you understand about the rules about recruitment now at youth level, where perhaps it's different or more challenging to bring in young players from European clubs,
yeah,
because of Brexit and the changes to visa requirements and things like that, whereas someone like Braden Clark came in from Wolves?
Yeah, I think that's much easier to do. I think if a player's under 18, as far as I understand it, it is pretty tricky and pretty difficult and pretty unlikely in most cases. So that obviously presents a barrier. And that's basically how Arsene Wenger built, you know, and Liam Brady constructed their academy teams, was cherry picking the best of European talent. When we were part of the EU, we could do that very easily and bring guys in. You know, I think technically at 16, but often the deals were done when they were kind of 15 years old. You know, the likes of Fabregas and Bentner and Lupoli and all Quincy, all these kids that we basically pinched off Europe's top academies. I don't think that's really viable anymore. So I think there'll be naturally a much more focus on a kind of UK scouting operation. And for example, I saw that Arsenal had signed a couple of youth scouts from Glasgow Rangers.
Right.
And there's talk that we might try and take a couple of Rangers players in for next season. That obviously gets us around some of the regulations, because obviously Scotland is Britain and it's, you know, but they are clubs that do produce their own players pretty frequently and have strong academies, particularly two Old Firm clubs. So that feels like a very clear strategic move of like, right, well, let's bring down a couple of top Scottish scouts and see if there's unexploited talent up in Scotland that we can reap the benefits of. So, yeah, and look, we've brought this Welsh centre-half in. I guess there's going to have to be a focus on the UK first and foremost.
Right. Speaking of the academy and speaking of youth players, we did have a question about Micah Beerith, who is a Danish under-21 player, but we got him from Fulham, if I'm right.
That's right, and he's got a UK passport as well.
So he was on loan at Motherwell, and the question is from Aquaman on Fire, who's at @Tom_Bond. It's a good image, isn't it? What happens if Aquaman goes on fire and he's already underwater? It's not like he can dive into more water to put himself out.
Mm-hmm. True.
There's an existential fucking question for everyone to get to terms with today. Anyway, he says, loner or loney, Micah Beerith is on fire this season at Motherwell and now Sturm Graz. He seems to have great positioning and finishing instincts. Do you think he's done enough to earn a squad rotation spot this season? And just to sort of put in context, he played 15 games for Motherwell, 6 goals and 5 assists. Right. And then he's gone to Sturm Graz. Made 11 appearances, scored 8 goals and 1 assist. So, you know, we often talk about young players going out and going on loan and, you know, can they do enough to show that they deserve a chance? Maybe more than anyone I can think of in recent times, he is certainly doing as much as possible to make Mikel Arteta and his coaching staff sit up and take notice.
Yeah. He scored goals all his life, basically. Scored goals his whole life. As a baby, he was scoring goals. It was his destiny. As much as Rocky wants to be a barman, he wanted to be a striker. And when we signed him from Fulham, I think he was the top goal scorer in the division at that time, at that level. He scored an absurd amount of goals for them. He's a really good, solid centre-forward player. He's 21 now, which I think with these talents, a lot of the time you feel if the first team breakthrough is going to happen, especially in the attacking part of the pitch, it tends to be a bit earlier than that. Like it tends to be kind of 18, 19, 20 that we do see these players in the Arsenal first team. I don't think he'll come back. I think he'll be sold.
What about all the chat about, you know, Arsenal signing another forward, and a discussion we've had time and time again. But maybe the other aspect of this situation is Eddie Nketiah, who we've also spoken about, whose minutes over the course of the last 3-4 months have really dwindled compared to the first part of the season. And, you know, being realistic from our perspective and being realistic from his perspective, is this summer the right time for an Eddie Nketiah move? I would say yes, it probably is. Do you then need to just have that third striker, that third forward in your squad? Could he be that guy? Or is it a case that, you know, while the stock is pretty high, on the back of I forgot Balogun, who, you know, had a great loan spell, didn't he? I'm sure there are people screaming at their phones when I mentioned that earlier. But, you know, is it a similar situation in that his stock is high? Everyone would say, give this guy a chance. But ultimately, as a way of generating revenue, you know, this might be the right time to sell him.
That's my gut feeling. And by the way, how interesting that you forgot Balogun. Like, it was such a big topic of debate last summer, you know, and so many people really, really wanted him to stay at the club. And understandably, I don't take any issue with that. Yeah, he had done brilliantly out on the loan. And yet we haven't really spoken about him since the season started in any discernible way. I think that shows it was probably the right call to let him go. I mean, obviously, we'll only know in the fullness of time. In terms of Eddie, I think you should all brace yourselves to hear the phrase 100% profit in terms of FFP quite a lot this summer. I think we're going to hear it a lot about Eddie Nketiah and Reece Nelson, maybe even Emile Smith Rowe. I think it's going to be relevant and part of the discussion and part of the, you know, strategy, I suppose, internally at Arsenal. So I think he probably will leave. In terms of Mika Beerith, he's done everything you can ask. He's 6'2", he's 21, he's playing for the Denmark under 21s, he's scoring goals at senior level. I just feel that he was almost signed. It was kind of his destiny to be a player that we eventually sold for profit. He was part of a group of players that we bought under the guys who were kind of leading academy recruitment at the time, where that was kind of the project, you know, was can we fill this squad with talent who can help the academy teams in the short term but be sold in the longer term? And I think that's always been where it's going with this player. But who knows? He might get a chance, right? Like, imagine if we haven't signed a striker and Eddie leaves early in the summer. He goes on the tour, let's say, of the US, plays a couple of games, scores a couple of goals. It could all change.
There is that aspect to this summer as well, isn't there? Because there is an international tournament. Which is probably...
Copa America as well.
Yeah, so it's probably going to have an impact on what Olympics. Arsenal and yeah, many... I saw a story about Thierry Henry wanting William Saliba to play in the Olympics. And I was like,
I bet he does.
Call yourself an Arsenal fan, Thierry. Yeah. How could you?
True test of his Arsenal fan.
Yeah. But it is going to have an impact on the summer, because a lot of players are going to be playing, you know, well into July because of the tournaments. And they're going to need some time off. That is the reality. They will need some time off. So, you know, it's possible that on the US tour and as other Premier League teams tour around the world, you know, there are going to be many, many star names and significant players who are not available to the manager. So it will require him to dig deep into the full depths of his squad in order to, you know, have enough players to work with over the course of these games.
Yeah. Look, he's an interesting player. He's a proper goal scorer, a proper centre forward. And he's got that knack of scoring goals. He's always had it, you know. And those players are always have a value attached to them. My feeling is just that Arsenal will look to cash in on that value, maybe to try and get someone in who's more first team ready. But but let's see. I would love it for him to get his chance as first team. I always like to see a young player given their chance. But I just think it'll be tricky for him. And I think it's also that thing where, a bit like Balogun, he's been out and been a first team regular all season. And I think once players, especially once they're flourishing at senior level, scoring goals, getting the international call-ups, I think going back to being like, well, you can sort of be the 23rd, 24th man in our squad, I'm not sure they always want that.
That's for sure. It must be the most frustrating thing, if you're a footballer and you love to play football, but you're just sort of like third choice in a position where there isn't really a huge amount of rotation over the course of a season. You barely play. I'm not being critical in any way of Reece Nelson, right? Not at all. I understand his love for the club and being part of this project must be very, very exciting. But on every weekend, you must be like, Jesus, here I am sitting on the bench. Might get a few minutes, might not.
Yeah.
That must be maddening or frustrating. Maybe some players are okay with it and used to it and can deal with that. But, I couldn't imagine training all week only to sit on the bench.
It's because you have to prepare yourself as if you're going to play.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And that's what the top pros do. They train like they're going to play. They do everything right. They do all the match preparation. And then lo and behold, same as last week, you're not in the starting 11 again.
Mm.
I think the stamina of sort of keeping that motivation going, despite that, it must be really challenging.
Yeah. And at some point you're going to want to play.
Yeah.
Surely. Okay. Well, look, why don't we hit pause here, take a little break, and we'll do some questions. I think now's a good time as any to do that. So we'll be back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you sent to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog. Also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. James, in the spirit of St. Patrick, you can go first. That was the other thing that St. Patrick is known for, letting other people go first.
On this podcast.
If he was going into a supermarket and there was a gentleman side by, he would let that guy go in. Same time.
Good guy. No wonder he got that sainthood. Okay. This is from Jan Hoppy. And I hope it's pronounced Jan. I've gone for Jan. It could be Jan, but I don't know. They ask, are you worried about how reliant we seem to have become on Jorginho? I thought we lost a bit of control when he went off against Porto. And although Havertz is developing well, he's never going to turn into a silky build-up player. And neither is Rice.
I mean, I don't know that we are reliant on Jorginho. I just think he's come in and played well and demonstrated why it was exactly that Mikel Arteta wanted to sign him a few years before he did. You know, which, you know, I'll hold my hands up. At the time, I was like, oh, no, not Jorginho, not this guy, not another Chelsea player. But I kind of, you know, wish maybe we had. And I wish he was maybe a couple of years younger. That is the best compliment I can play to him. You know, does his presence in the team and does his experience, his technical quality, does it maybe tell Mikel Arteta what he might need to do in the summer if he doesn't already know? Perhaps, but I don't know that we're reliant on him. I just think he's been very good and very influential. But I don't think it's a case that we can't win games without him.
No, nor do I, but I think he's in our best team at the present point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are going to be weeks where, you know, we'll have three games in 7 or 8 days. And he's not going to be able to play all those minutes.
No.
I don't think. So that challenge, you know, that will be interesting to see how and when Mikel Arteta deploys him. I think he's going to play... My gut would say he's going to play the biggest games. And then, you know, if we have slightly more favourable fixtures, you know, home games in the Premier League, we might try and manage without him to protect him for the Champions League. I think he's going to play. And, you know, the likes of City and United and Spurs, I imagine he'll play as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, I don't think we'll be able to rely on him in every minute. So what happens there in the midfield is going to be interesting to see. You know, does Thomas Partey come back into the rotation and play a little bit? He looked super rusty, didn't he, when we've seen him so far.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always kind of been the way with Thomas. It takes him time to kind of get up to speed.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned him. We had a question here from Angard Away, who's away at Away Angard. On Twitter, he said, with a hectic April, we'll likely need one or two of our fringe players to hit form and start a handful of games. Who do you think will play the most out of Smith Rowe, Partey, Nelson, Vieira, Tomiyasu, Zinchenko, and Eddie Nketiah?
Out of that list, I think Zinchenko will play the most.
Mm, me too.
I thought there was a decent chance Zinchenko might come back into the side for the Porto game, actually. I just think Arteta finds Zinchenko quite irresistible. And history shows that when he's fit, he just is so tempted to play him, you know, because of how much he offers you. I'm not saying he's wrong even to be that tempted. But I was almost surprised he stuck with Jakub Kivior for the Porto game. So I think he'll play the most minutes out of that bunch. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, that's who I would pick out of all of those players, simply because he has a track record of playing a lot of minutes and the others don't. You know, Partey did, but you know, the signing of Declan Rice and the influence of Jorginho has made his absence not something we've missed or noticed a huge amount this season.
I'd like to think Tomiyasu could get some minutes.
I think he will. I was just about who's going to play the most out of that. I think Tomiyasu will. You know, it'll be very interesting to see where Tomiyasu plays as well, because things have changed a little bit, haven't they? In that he was probably, you know, timber aside, first choice backup left back, if that makes sense. You know, when Zinchenko wasn't there, if Tomiyasu's fit, then Tomiyasu plays there. But Kivior has done very well. I think there's a defensive solidity to our recent run that he's been part of and deserves credit for, but also the role of Ben White has changed since Kivior has played at left back. And Arteta decided, I think after the Fulham game, he decided that, right, I can't ask Kivior to do the Zinchenko hybrid kind of thing that the Tomiyasu is capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he decided that Kivior wasn't and isn't capable of doing that, so tweaked his team and moved Ben White a little more internal and all that. So, you know, when he comes back, is that something Tomiyasu is going to have to do if he plays on the right?
Quite possibly.
Mm.
Quite possibly. It's a really interesting one. But to come back to Zinchenko, I think even if you... I just think there are so many scenarios in which I can see Zinchenko getting on the pitch, even if he doesn't start. You know, if things aren't going your way and you need a goal, you need to turn it round, I think he'd probably be the first guy on the bench that Arteta would look to. So I think even if he doesn't start a great deal, I think he'll get plenty of minutes.
You know what I also think is quite interesting about the Zinchenko thing is that there was a time, I think, where you could make the argument that the defensive weaknesses in his game were something that you, to one degree or another, kind of had to accept because he brought a lot to the attacking side of our game. How true is that now? I'm not saying the only reason we played well was when Zinchenko did his thing, right? But he did have a very, very big influence on this team. And I'm not sure that influence is as great as it used to be. Therefore, does it change how you view those defensive weaknesses?
Yeah, I think it does. I think maybe the team has shown that it's a little less reliant on Zinchenko than we might have previously been. I do think, actually, I know we've talked about both these players already, but there is kind of a relationship between Zinchenko and Jorginho.
Mm-hmm.
I think we probably need one of them on the pitch. In fact, there was a period, I think, against Porto where we didn't have either, and I think we slightly lost our way. And I kind of think that it might be the case, you know, I'm saying Jorginho can't play every game. Well, maybe it's those games that he doesn't play where we will really need Zinchenko.
Mm.
I think, you know, they both bring so much in build-up with their passing in similar areas, you know, even though one is ostensibly starting as a left-back, that I think one of them really needs to be on the pitch for us, probably.
Mm.
But it's interesting sort of figuring out who and when.
Yeah.
Partly because of those, you know, defensive issues that you mentioned. And I'm still fascinated. I still think quite a lot about that home Liverpool game where Arteta played Jorginho as the higher midfielder and Rice deeper.
Mm.
And I keep thinking back to that and why he made that choice.
Was that the FA Cup game or the league game?
I think it was the league game because I was in my season ticket for it. And yeah, don't quote me on that, but I think it was the league game.
Mm.
And he did that. And I sort of thought, is that because Liverpool are so good on the break? You know, and he thinks Rice is just that much quicker or that much more able to cope with the athleticism of Liverpool if they break on us than Jorginho would be. So I think to an extent, Zinchenko and Jorginho are both players who give you a ton in possession. And if there is a weaker part of their game, maybe it is out of possession. I think Jorginho's pretty good in that respect, but maybe, you know, he's not Declan Rice, is he? Athletic.
Yeah, he's not going to cover the ground.
Yeah. So it's such a careful balancing act, isn't it? To kind of support them in the team structure in the right way. Just as a side point, I had a question from Kivior. About Kivior, not from Kivior. It'd be nice if Kivior sent a question in.
It would be.
How do you think I'm doing, guys?
Great, keep it up.
Yeah. Well, listen to this question from Jamie B. I'll be interested to see your take on it. Morning, both. Not a question I love to ask, but could Kivior be a candidate for selling this summer? We know we're going to have to start selling players we like, and his age profile and wages mean he could be appealing to teams outside of the Premier League bubble. If we want to change things up at left back, would he be an easier sale than Zinchenko?
I mean, probably he would be an easier sell than Zinchenko, but I think the other aspect of Kivior is the fact that he's also a left-footed center half. So...
But Gabriel, touch wood, cross everything.
Yeah, I know, I know, I know. Don't say it, don't say it. Don't
I'm not going to say it.
But you know what I mean? That is part of his role in the squad as well. And I think, look, Tomiyasu plays left-sided centre-back for Japan and does it very, very well. But can you be sure that Tomiyasu will be available if, you know, Gabriel was out injured or something like that? I'm not sure that's a safe bet. So I do think that while, yes, on paper, it would probably be easier to sell Kivior because I think his stock has risen, you know, over the last couple of months. He's played well. He's developed as a player. He looks much more settled. Therefore, there are probably teams out there who will look at him and say, hey, you know what? We could do worse than having a look at this guy. You can't ignore the fact that his role in the squad as it stands is also as cover for Gabriel in that left-sided centre-half position. So I would be very surprised if we sold him after, what, just 18 months? Because he arrived in January, didn't he? He came in January, same as Trossard and Jorginho, has now started to settle in and play pretty well and become part of the team. Unless there's like a massive pressing issue with how much money we need to raise in the transfer market this summer, I'd be very, very surprised. I think you said here a couple of weeks ago that the Zinchenko situation is one maybe just to keep an eye on because of how long he's got left on his contract. I'd be surprised if we sold Zinchenko, or I'd be surprised if there was a significant buyer as well for Zinchenko. But I wouldn't be inclined to move Kivior on without having another player to come in and play that backup center half role, and having put the work into getting Kivior to this point, it just seems a bit. Yeah, why would you? Unless the offer was ridiculous.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think if you'd asked me in December or January, I would have been quite sure. I would have said, "Oh, I think he'll go in the summer," and that wouldn't have purely been guesswork on my part. You know, that would have been informed by conversations around him and about him, and his, you know, that was kind of the way it looked for him at that point in time. He wasn't getting much game time, and it wasn't clear, you know, what his pathway was at Arsenal. That has obviously changed significantly since then. He's done really well at left back, particularly in recent weeks. I thought he was excellent against Porto. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, Man City paid, what, 90 million euros for Josep Guardiol, the player Arsenal also really liked. And he's been playing a kind of similar left-back role for City. And I think Kivior's done as well as him, basically, in recent weeks. So I take my hat off to him. I think he'll stay. For me, the weird thing is we still haven't seen him really in the position he was bought for, which is left-sided centre-back. We've barely seen him there. He had that little run as a right-sided centre-back towards the end of last season. I don't know if you remember, but yeah, Saliba out, he played games. Like, he played the Newcastle game, I think, and one or two others.
Yeah, it was when the holding situation became
untenable.
That's the word I was looking for, yes. Thank you.
And, I think the question makes a good point. There's a market for Kivior. I can see lots of clubs in Italy who would pay, you know, 30 million euros and be able to afford his salary, and they take him as a starting centre-half for them. But does it make sense for us? Is it just leaving us with another hole to fill? I think given how well he's done, I think he'll probably be here next season right now.
All right. Here's a question from Louis Leddy, or Louis Leddy. I never know how, you know, someone might prefer to be pronounced. Is it Louis or Louis? Don't know.
Don't know.
How are we supposed to know?
We've hedged our bets, I think, sufficiently.
That's fair enough. Okay, he says, after seeing quite a lot of reliable sources report Arsenal have a keen interest in Pedro Neto, do you think this season's injury record and perhaps previous seasons will see Arsenal put off going for him? The talent is unquestionable, but not worth much if constantly sidelined, and I think it was reported over the weekend that it's season over for him. I think...
Well, yeah. I mean, that's good because we play Wolves relatively soon after they've gone out of the FA Cup.
Yeah, Wolves suffer blow as Neto likely to miss rest of season with injury. And I was watching this, watching the game that he got injured in. He just went beyond a defender and pulled up and obviously a hamstring straight away, but not one of those where the player goes, oh, fuck, my hamstring has snapped in two. Looked like a sort of regular hamstring strain, but it's a pretty serious one after a serious one at the start of the season as well.
Yeah. It's a tough one for me because I love the player. I really, really do. Same. Think he's incredibly exciting and sort of tactically, technically, stylistically, he is such a good fit for us. But... yeah, I think it probably is at the point where you go, I don't know if this is a good idea. Unless there's some sort of, you know, nugget of medical information that would give Arsenal more comfort or a surgery that could be done that would resolve these problems for good. I just think, why would you take on that level of risk?
Mm.
What do you reckon?
I'm like you. I love him. I love watching him. He's so exciting when he plays, and I think he would fit this Arsenal team perfectly on the left and on the right as well. Yeah. I think, you know, he's got that ability to play on both sides. It'd be crazy not to be worried about the injuries, though. Whether they feel like it might be something they can get on top of, I don't know. I don't know how much medical information they might get before they make a decision about a player. You know, we've seen players with bad injury records come to Arsenal and do well. You know, think of someone like Mark Overmars. I remember, you know, when we signed him, I think he'd done his ACL, and it was at a time when there were question marks about whether a player would ever be the same after doing their ACL. And Arsenal decided, you know, he's what we need. And we obviously got quite a bit out of him for a few years before he went to Barcelona.
Yeah, we signed Kanu, obviously, in very different circumstances. But there were huge concerns over his capacity to play football again.
Yeah.
You know.
So, you know, if they get some assurance from the information that they get, and maybe the risk aspect also influences the price that you have to pay for him, and you can make that gamble, well, look, if we can keep him fit and because of this injury record we're getting him for a bit cheaper than we thought we might, then maybe they could go for him. But, you know, it's so easy to see him tearing down the wing at the Emirates and then going, ow.
Yeah, the old sniper shot to the hamstring.
Exactly.
And he's under contract at Wolves, and it may be that, you know, we can say, oh, we'd like to pay a reduced price for him, but it may be that it's more worth it for them to keep him and have him for half the games or whatever he's able to play than to sell him. Although, you know, they may still be managing a bit of an FFP situation there, so they might have other motivating factors to move him on. Yeah, it's a tricky one. It's funny, isn't it, with deals? Injury history is so important in player identification in the transfer market. And the medical is the last thing you do. Like by the time you do the medical, the deal is basically happening. Like, and in some cases, it's almost too late, right? There's been too much. You know, there's no time to source someone else if Kim Charlstrom's got a broken back.
Yes.
I always wonder if, like, would a club ever, you know, we know clubs tap players up. We know they, you know, meet them on Zooms or whatever, or have clandestine chats about their intentions. Could you ever get a player in for a medical before you start talking to the club?
I don't know. I mean, it is fascinating because, I mean, someone like Mikel Arteta, signed for Arsenal without a medical because there was just no time to do that. And then there were all the... there was all that stuff about the deal, if you remember, you know, the the conditions of the deal changed and it looked like it was not going to happen. And then, you know, Arteta made it go through. But yeah, you're right. You're right. Again, I'd be fascinated to know, like, if you're going to buy a player from a club, how does it work when you, I presume you can, let's say Arsenal go to Wolves and say, we would like to make a bid for Pedro Neto. The bid is accepted. Like, to what extent are you provided with the player's full medical history by the selling club?
Mm.
Like, do you get the charts? Do you get the, like, the physios, the doctor, you know, the red zone information, you know, all the information that Arsenal have about their own players and their physical capabilities? Do they provide that to another club if that, you know, if that club wants to sign them?
Well, if it's Pedro Neto's medical history, they'll have to bring it down in a lorry, I imagine.
Yeah, it'd be like one of those court cases where, you know, a big corporation is trying to fucking, you know, bury them in paperwork, just truck after truck after truck of...
Yeah. Oh. I don't know how... And I guess it depends on what the selling club's intentions are. You know, how much do they want to play ball and get rid of this player? Or, you know, in a case like Pedro Neto, it might be in their interest to not share all that information because, you know, maybe there's stuff in there that's going to put off potential buyers. I think this whole question of availability is a really interesting one and a pertinent one for Arsenal ahead of this summer transfer window. I think it could have implications for current players. You know, we've spoken about Zinchenko, but Thomas Partey, Gabriel Jesus. I think that question of, like, you know, we believe in these players' talent, but how often are we able to guarantee they'll be out there on the pitch? I think that will factor heavily in Arteta's squad building and Edu's squad building decisions this summer. You know, we've already seen a bit of that with Kieran Tierney in the past. You know, they liked him as a player, but could he be relied upon to stay fit? And I think you have to ask similar questions of other players we've got in the squad. And I don't think, if we're being sensible, we should be bringing in players who have those questions hanging over them as well.
I think that's fair.
With a heavy heart, because I do really like him, Pedro Neto.
So who else is it going to be? There's the other thing. There's the other aspect. It's like, now who are they going to get?
Yeah.
Who else do they like?
Nico Williams probably is the one I fancy. Is that his name? Yeah.
Oh, from Athletic?
Yeah.
I like him a lot.
He's ticking a lot of my boxes, that guy. And crucially, I don't think he's injured all the time. So that's good. on the subject of the Bayern game, Femi Colioso. I'm slightly starstruck that we've got a question from Femi Colioso because he's the drummer with Ezra Collective and Gorillaz. But he asks, hi, guys. What scoreline do you think we need at the Emirates as a minimum to see us weather Munich and progress? It might seem a lot, but I think we need 3-0. 2-0 at a stretch. Thanks for everything, guys. Love everything you do. Peace. 3-0. That's a big ask, Femi, for the first leg.
It is. It's a very big ask. I mean, I'd be quite happy with a 1-0. I mean, I'd like 3-0, of course. But I think if we can go to Munich with a lead of any kind, we'll be in good shape.
What would make you feel comfortable?
7-0. yeah.
7-0. Okay.
7-0.
Or 8-1.
8-1 I could live with, yeah.
Away goals rule, I'll take 8-1.
Yeah. I mean, we know Harry Kane's going to get the penalty, so if it's a consolation penalty when we're 8-0 up, I'll take that.
I think if we go to Bayern, if we can somehow get a 2-goal lead from that first leg, then we are massive favourites to go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know we have been battered at Bayern before, but we've also got some decent results there, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we have.
We nearly overturned something once upon a time.
That's right. Yeah, they went through on away goals, and at the end of the game, they were just keeping the ball by the corner flag because they were, you know, they knew one goal would send Arsenal through. So
yeah, we won 2-0, didn't we? Right?
Giroud scored and...
Koscielny, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, probably. Sounds like a Koscielny thing to do.
And there was another game. Maybe we ended up getting battered. What was there? It was a game where Podolski scored against them. And I remember feeling happy for a few minutes. I don't know how long it lasted.
Let's see.
Bayern Arsenal results. Head-to-head history, Bayern Arsenal.
Yeah, there was a 1-1. There was a 1-1. Podolski actually equalized after Bastian Schweinsteiger had put Bayern Munich 1-0 up. This was in March 2014.
Yeah. We'd lost the home leg 2-0 by that point.
Thomas
Muller. I don't remember that goal, but he absolutely roofed it, didn't he?
Podolski, yeah.
So, you know, we've done okay, actually, at the Allianz.
Apart from, like, the last time and the time before that.
The 5-1. Yeah. 5-1. That wasn't good, that one.
I'd absolutely take a 2-0. I think 2-0 puts us in a great position to go and win the game in Munich. But like any lead I'll take going into the away leg. It's just so hard to predict, isn't it? Like, just so hard.
Listen, 2-0, and I think we're in a really strong position. We have to believe this Arsenal team are unlike some of the previous Arsenals. I do think they look less likely to just get obliterated anywhere, to be honest.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Who knows? Exasperated horse noise. Who knows?
Exactly.
Let me ask you this one from Saint Cazorla. Saint Cazorla's Day today as well, by the way. Every day is Saint Cazorla's Day. He says, assuming Ramsdale is sold, who should we be looking at for backup keepers? What is the profile? A Raya in the making or someone who might have a chance of pushing Raya out?
Good question. I just hope we do something that makes sense. Like, I think somebody else said, what Errol B said, I don't understand why it's a given that Ramsdale will leave. If I was him, I'd rather be part of this immense journey Arsenal are on and fight for my place than be first choice goalie at a mid-table team. I think it's different for a keeper. Like, Reece Nelson knows he might get off the bench. He's at least got that. I think as a goalie, your opportunities are so limited that I think he will want to go. I also think for Arsenal, like, it's probably, you know, we're talking about selling players to make some money, bring some money into the club. You know, he's a potential case for that. You know, is it worth having all that resource in one part of the pitch with those two goalkeepers when one's not going to play? I don't know. So I just hope we do something that makes sense. And by that, I mean, we don't, and with respect to Matt Turner, I hope we don't go and buy another Matt Turner, who for me was always a weird, weird, weird signing because he was bad at the very stuff we need an Arsenal goalkeeper to be good at.
Yeah. Particularly when you consider how ruthlessly Mikel Arteta chose to go with David Raya over Aaron Ramsdale, despite the difference between them as, you know, ball players being, I think it's there, it's obvious, but not huge by any means. I mean, is it about time that Mikel Arteta just sort of, okay, this is my goalkeeper now? Because we have spent quite a lot of money on goalkeepers. You know, we spent a lot on Ramsdale. He brought in, well, I know it was a weird circumstance, but the Alex Runarsson deal, you know, again, doesn't reflect particularly well on whoever's making the choice about these goalkeepers. Matt Turner, lovely guy, but as you say, sort of at odds with what we want from a goalkeeper and, you know, relatively expensive, you know, coming from an MLS club. And now we have been linked with another goalkeeper from the US as well. I can't remember
Patrick Schulte. Yeah, I don't think he is the guy. Based on sort of, you know, the digging I've done around that one, I don't think that he's like the target for the goalkeeping position. To be honest, I don't know anything about him, Patrick Schulte, so I can't really comment on his ability, but I don't think he's like a high target, priority target for Arsenal. So, yeah, I think you make a good point. I think that it's a bit frustrating, I'm sure, for recruitment that they keep having to go out and kind of fix the goalkeeping part of the squad.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they would like it to be more settled than that. Does it not also, I suppose, kind of illustrate the difficulty of that position in that it's really hard to have a good second choice and keep them happy?
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost impossible. You get a year out of it, is what we're learning. Like, even Matt Turner, like, he was stylistically, he wasn't the right fit for Arsenal, but also he was an international goalkeeper who wanted to play every week.
Yeah.
And by the time the end of the season rolled around, you know, he was looking to move. So how do you do it? So, you know, we have spoken in the past about the route of like a more experienced, someone who is more towards the end of their career, who's maybe more at peace with being a backup. You know, that is a way of doing it. I just hope we buy someone who can play in the game model, like who can play with his feet and do all this stuff so that if Aaron leaves and Raya's injured, we're not like, oh, shit.
we have to change.
We can't play our football.
Yeah. I mean, I think on that basis, it has to be somebody who is
Spanish.
Spanish. I just think stylistically something similar to Raya with what they're capable of doing on the ball, and also with the kind of distribution we ask of David Raya, that quick distribution, which, you know, Ramsdale is capable of as well. But like you said, it's sort of easier said than done. But I do think if, you know, after spending 60, 70 million pounds on goalkeepers all in, I do think Mikel Arteta needs to just sort of settle in that position for a little while anyway. You know, the idea that you can always improve your squad, I think, has to be fundamental to the way that you operate and the way that you look at recruitment, right? So if an opportunity comes along to upgrade any player in any position, you have to be ready, willing, and able to do that. But, like, changing your goalkeeper every 12 to 18 months just doesn't seem that sensible to me, because I think you do need a bit of consistency in that position. And I know there are other reasons as to why Manchester City and Liverpool have been the best two teams in the Premier League. But what they've had is, you know, their goalkeeper with them through most of this, you know, this modern era. You know, they haven't changed. They've changed their number twos and will continue to do so, I think, because, you know, there's such a big drop off. But they've stuck with their number one. And I think that's something that Arsenal need to do.
And listen, as much as I was willing to kind of entertain Arteta's idea of competition and rotation, I do basically think when it comes to goalkeeping, it's sort of bollocks. And like, it doesn't really work fundamentally. Like, I don't want any more cutaways to the guy on the bench, you know, every time a ball goes in the net. I think that position psychologically benefits from a hierarchy, a clear hierarchy, and clear roles. And I think that's the way we should go. I know there are people who are like, I like Raya, but I'm not convinced he's the guy. But I'm with you. I don't think this is the time for more instability in that position. I think, you know, when they sign Raya permanently, you'll get a nice long-term contract. And then I think you are looking for a deputy. And it'll be someone who knows that's their role coming in. But, you know, they've got to be of the requisite quality to play if required and the right style. But I think, yeah, I think a hierarchy in some ways is healthy.
Yeah, and it might be a case that Arsenal need to, even if Raya is the number one, put a bit of thought into the goalkeeping position this summer, because the third choice at the moment is Carl Hein, who, although he hasn't played a great deal, is an international goalkeeper. But I think he's out of contract in the summer, isn't he? So if Ramsdale goes and Hein goes, is there somebody at youth level ready to step up? I'm not sure. So you could be looking at having to recruit both a number two and sort of a backup goalkeeper as well, who can play that role as sort of third man with the goalkeeping group.
Yeah, exactly. So Listen, if there's one thing we love doing, it's signing goalkeepers, Andrew.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a trademark Arsenal summer in that respect.
All right. What about this one? Just to finish, it's kind of a fun one to finish. J-Boz says, you have to choose one player for the last 10 games to join Arsenal for the final push to the title. These players are in their peak and won't be injured. You have three choices here. Zinedine Zidane, Ronaldo, like the real Ronaldo, and Maradona.
Zinedine Zidane, Ronaldo, and Maradona. Wow. Oh my word, that's tricky, isn't it?
It sort of is, but I've got a clear choice here.
You've got a clear choice.
Yeah. Like in their peak.
Well, I actually don't know, Anne. What's your clear choice then?
Ronaldo. Ronaldo in his peak, at his pomp, in the number nine position. Just the idea of him at his best playing up front for Arsenal. I think we would no longer have to have the conversation about Arsenal needing to sign a forward. If that was what we had, you can talk around how stylistically would he fit, would he not fit. And look, the other two are amazing players, Maradona and Zidane. I'm just not sure that Mikel Arteta would stand for Maradona's cocaine consumption, like even in his peak. I feel like that might be one of his, you know, non-negotiables, lads.
Maybe.
Zero cocaine. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. It's probably, yeah, it's even worse than Vucic has smoking in the showers. You know, it's Maradona doing cocaine in the toilet. I
lashing out the lines at halftime.
They call him the groundsman because he lays the white lines out on the pitch. Hey. I think, I mean, Maradona, for me, it's hard to call, isn't it? But for me, he's the best player of the three. Like, he was a player who could just make a team win almost on his own, you know? It was extraordinary. But actually, I have to be honest and say my gut was saying Zizou, just in terms of the shape and the structure of this team. Like, stick him in that left eight, we'll be laughing,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, That would work for me as well, like, you know, all three, but just in my own
little... I'll shock you, Andrew. I'd take any of them. R9 up front would be fun.
Imagine.
It would be fun.
I know.
Yeah. I think you might have swayed me there, it's a fun hypothetical.
It sure is. Okay. We are going to leave it there. You can join us over on Patreon a little bit later on. We will be doing an episode of The 30, which is our look back at all the weekend's Premier League action, but we might touch a little bit on some of the FA Cup stuff as well. So you can join myself and Phil with that a bit later on. Patreon.com/arseblog. For now, take it easy. Thanks for being with us as always, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.